Welcome to the season premiere of On Her Turf podcast. I'm Catherine Tappan. Thank you so much to everyone who joined us for season one. We are super excited about the guests that we have coming this season. So make sure you tune in, check us out wherever you listen to your podcast, like us on Instagram, and join the conversation. So for the first episode, we decided to honor the women who are the face of NBC's coverage of the Kentucky Derby. Derby Day, Saturday, May 4th, one of the greatest sporting events to watch. And the two faces that you know well from our team coverage are Donna Brothers and Brittany Yerton. Donna is one of the most decorated female jockeys of all time. She is an award-winning reporter. Brittany, she's young, she's beautiful, she's smart, she comes from a horse racing family, but she's also carved out her own path in the industry. So take a listen. It's their perspective, not only on horse racing, but their journey in a male-dominated field and how they balance their personal and professional lives. We are very excited to have Donna Brothers join us now on the podcast. And Donna, this is an exciting time of year for you. You are busy gearing up for the Triple Crown. So just describe your excitement at this point of the season and getting ready for that first race, the Kentucky Derby.
Well, Catherine, as you well know, a lot of preparation goes into a thing like the Kentucky Derby. And so really, I start preparing when the two-year-olds are running in their big races in the summer. So I've been watching these horses for a long time already. And it's really exciting to see them all come together in Kentucky, right? So you've watched a lot of these horses compete in California or Florida or New York or Kentucky. But then finally, on the first Saturday of May, we get them all to converge on the same track, same day, same time, same race. And it's super exciting, especially if you follow horse racing all year round and for a lifetime like I do.
It has been a lifetime. I mean, let me go back to, you know, your experience as a jockey, but you're coming from a family of jockeys, including your mother. Describe to me what it was like growing up for you. What lessons and advice that your mom gave you when you were a young child?
I guess I should start by saying Mom never encouraged any of us to become jockeys. We just all ended up becoming jockeys. And I honestly didn't think I wanted to be a jockey. It felt to me like a fairly mundane occupation. My mother did that. I mean, how exciting could that be? And so I didn't really, when I was growing up, I wasn't ever asking her for advice about, well, if I become a jockey, what about this? What about that? But one of the things that really surprised me, first of all, the first time I rode a race, I was 21 years old, and I did it to eliminate that as a career option before I decided to move on to something else. And I really didn't think it was going to be as challenging as it ended up being. And so I rode the first race, and I came back, and I was like, oh, my God, not only is that the most exciting thing I've ever done in my life, it's definitely the most challenging. And so I had a passion. I had a challenge. And what really surprised me is that over the course of the next few years, I would be riding a race or being preparing to ride a race. And I would think, like, what am I going to do about this situation? What do I do in that situation? And I would hear my mother's advice just come to me because I'd spent so much time in the jocks room and listened to her talking to other riders. And so that part surprised me, is how much I really had been taking in without thinking any of it was intended for me. And so I realized how lucky I was to grow up in her household.
Yeah. I mean, so you were 21 years old when you had your first race.
Mm-hmm.
I was just curious what the plan would have been if you did not choose to go that route with your career. I mean, what were your other interests at the time?
Yeah. So I graduated from high school a year early, which was not really part of the plan because I just wasn't planning on graduating here early. But then my mother was getting ready to marry her fifth husband. And I was like, yeah, I'm kind of done with the husbands. It's time for me to move on. So I went to my guidance counselor. I was like, look, you know, I have enough credits. My grades are good. What do I have to do? And so she helped me figure out a way to get out of here early. I had to do summer school, a couple correspondence courses. And so all of a sudden I leave and I did not have a college plan. I had planned on college when I was in high school, but with my early exit, I really didn't have a college plan, so I gravitated towards what I knew, which was the racetrack. And I thought, well, I'll just go, you know, gallop horses in the morning, just exercise them in the morning and pay my way through college. And it really didn't take me long to learn that I really wasn't making enough money to pay my way through college, and I was working a lot. I mean, 7 days a week. It's just in the morning, really. But and the more I did it, the more I started to realize, and I don't want to pat myself on the back, but I grew up riding horses my entire life. And so for me, I took my communication with horses for granted. I thought that was just that it came easily for everyone. But once I started galloping horses as an exercise rider in that sort of environment, I realized it didn't come easily for everyone. And so maybe this was easier for me than other people. And also it was naturally light, but light as in I only weighed 98 pounds. Mm-hmm. And so then it was when I was 21 that a family friend, I was in Birmingham, Alabama at the time, at a racetrack there called Birmingham Turf Club. And he offered me a job to come back to Kentucky and train horses for a living. And so I thought, well, I need to decide what I'm going to do. I'm either going to go train horses. I should eliminate being a jockey as a career option, or I need to go to college because I still haven't done that. And so I rode this one race just to eliminate it as a career option. And it consumed me for the next 11 and a half years. And I really did love it. And by the way, I finally made it to college in 2002. And then NBC came in. So when I went to college in 2002, I was doing four shows a year for NBC at the time. And I went for 2.5 years. And by the end of that, I was doing 20 shows a year for NBC. And so I decided to take the job that paid versus the one that didn't. And I still haven't graduated from college, but I finally went, Catherine.
Oh, I love that story. I mean, hey, maybe it's just not for you. You know, the college thing is not for everybody sometimes. Yes. And you have clearly paved your way in an unbelievable career and industry. So do you have any desire to go back and finish? You said 2.5 years were complete. Do you have any desire to finish it up?
I used to. I used to think that I really wanted to do that. But I've realized that, first of all, I love what I do for NBC, besides covering the thoroughbred racing, some of the equestrian events, too. And, it had me torn, too divided. And I don't know how long I'll do this for NBC. I think for as long as I love it and as long as they love me. But I also know that I'll probably be one of those people who always does continuing education and takes courses here and there. But there's still a lot of other things that I want to do. And I think sitting in class for the next year and a half isn't one of them.
Yeah. Aw. Well, you're outside, you're embracing nature, these wonderful horses and the thoroughbreds. I mean, you're around such amazing, inspiring things every single day, but you're also, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast about being in a male dominated industry and you are surrounded, you know, a room full of jockeys. Mm-hmm. And you're surrounded by these big personalities as well. What were some of the things you learned early on and in ways that you were able to gain confidence in that kind of environment?
Well, I'll have to back up to my mother again. So my mother came up at a time when it was a bit more divisive. Not all the men in the jocks room were all that happy with women deciding that they were going to infringe upon their sport. So when she was licensed in 1969 as a female jockey, she was one of the first half dozen women to be licensed as such. And so she was met with some resistance. And my mother was a scrapper. She would fight at the drop of a hat. And so nobody was going to give her any crap without hearing about it. And so, yeah, Mom got in many, many altercations in the jocks room. Usually she won. Wow. She said that her way of putting it was that she couldn't lose because if a guy beat her up, all he did was beat up a girl. And if she beat him up, then she got beat up he got beat up by a girl. And so about 10 years ago, I asked my mom, Mom, I think the reason why most people don't fight is because they're afraid they're going to get hurt. Like, did it ever occur to you that you could get hurt? And she paused and looked up in the sky like she was looking for an answer and then said, no, I never thought about that.
Awesome.
I know, but I was not a scrapper. I was more, I would rather reason with people. And so one of the things that I learned to do early on in the jocks room, we have stewards who oversee every single race. And every single time that there's any sort of an infraction where a horse bumps another horse or, anything like that happens, the stewards look at all that. They review the race. And if you're an apprentice rider, you have to go review films the next day, no matter what, whether you are involved in an infraction or not, because they expect that you'll learn from that. And so as an apprentice rider, whenever I would have one of the guy jockeys come back and yell at me and say that I had done something wrong, I would say, I'm sorry. Do you mind going to the stewards with me tomorrow and watching the film with me so that you can show me what I did wrong? And so one of two things would happen then. If they were just trying to bully me, they didn't want to go in front of the stewards and talk about what I did wrong when I didn't really do anything wrong. But the second thing was, is if they were being sincere and they really wanted me to know I had erred, out on the racetrack, then they appreciated the fact that I wanted to learn and that I was willing to learn. And so I didn't have to do the altercation route that my mother did. I was able to sort of rise above the fray, if you will. And I felt like I was in a situation where we all had mutual respect for one another, me with the guys and the guys for me. And I will say also to my mother's credit that if she ever felt like she came up against any female discrimination, she certainly never gave it a voice. So I never heard my mother say that I didn't get this opportunity or that opportunity because I was a girl. I believe that in her head, she believed that if she wasn't getting the opportunities, it was either because she wasn't good enough or they didn't know how good she was yet. And so she would just prove herself. And luckily I was raised with that. And so when I got to the racetrack and I was still a female in a male dominated sport, I never felt like anybody discriminated against me based on gender. I felt like either I wasn't good enough yet or they didn't know how good I was and I was going to prove it. But I did notice that all the riders who did really well worked really hard. And so I just worked really hard and kept trying to improve.
Can you remember along the way times where you did face that adversity of somebody maybe questioning your ability or questioning your desire or any of your work ethic? I mean, did you ever run into a time where you had to prove yourself in that situation?
There were times when trainers would say, you know, well, I want a strong rider on that horse. You know, he just needs a strong handler. And one of the things that I guess I should say, you know, as a jockey, we're at even weights. And so I would work out at the gym with a lot of these same jockeys that I rode with. And all the jockeys could attest to the fact that I could lift just as much as they could. But certainly my legs were as strong. My arms were as strong. And so all the jockeys knew that. They couldn't say I wasn't strong. And so I would just say, like, you know, I'm as strong as they are. And by the way, I don't have to reduce. I don't have to watch my weight. So I eat two meals a day, two solid meals a day. I don't have to go into the hot box and pull any weight. So I'm not dehydrated. And so there would be times when I would have to remind trainers that I was as strong as the men, because I think the basic, you know, just the perception is that I might have more finesse, but I'm not going to have more strength. And I would have to remind people from time to time that that just wasn't true. Not when we're all at equal weights and I hit the gym harder than they do.
I love it. What do you do for the workouts? I mean, I guess it's probably different now than what you did, you know, more, you know, when you were competing and you were more active. But what exactly do you do now? And what does that diet consist of? You mentioned two meals a day. Is that still what you do?
Yeah, well, the reason why I did it then was because I woke up at 4:35 o'clock in the morning. I was at the track by 5:30, 5:50 every day, and I would be on my first horse by 6 o'clock in the morning. So the last thing you want is breakfast, right? Like, first of all, yeah. It's too early. It was even too early for coffee. I would have a cup of coffee when I got done at the track in the morning. It was too early for coffee at 4:30 a.m.
Yes,
very early. And so, so I would go out to the track and get on horses from about 6 a.m. to about 9:30 a.m. Then I'd head up to the jocks room, and that's when I would finally have a cup of coffee. And then I would usually take a nap, lay down for about 15 minutes, and then I would wake up and take a shower, and then I would have some lunch. And now you have to keep in mind, now it's about 11 o'clock, and the first post is about 12 o'clock. And so I don't want to eat very much because I'm getting ready to go ride races. And then at dinner, I would always have a big dinner, like a really big dinner. And people would watch me eat dinner, and they would go like, where on earth do you put that? Like, how does somebody use that? But they didn't realize like that I, for the most part, hadn't eaten very much all day long, and I don't eat breakfast. So that was kind of my meal was dinner. Lunch would have been like a half of a tuna fish sandwich and maybe a half of an apple tops, like not very much. So I got in the habit of doing that when I was a jockey. And then when I retired from riding, I just have never been a breakfast eater. I've never been hungry in the morning. I don't want breakfast. And so, yeah, I usually do just two meals a day. And if I have to skip lunch, I'm okay with that too. But I'm usually pretty hungry by dinner.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
So my workouts now are a little different. Yeah, when I was a jockey, obviously getting on the horses is a workout in and of itself. And then in addition to that, I would lift weights to build my strength. And also I would run about 3 miles, I would say 4 days a week, just to make sure my cardiovascular fitness was up. But now I'm pretty much more like just yoga. I weight train one day a week. I do yoga usually 2 days a week. And then I do spinning like 2 days a week. And then the other day I'll just do whatever I feel like doing. It might be Pure Bar. It might be Orange Theory Fitness. Mm-hmm. You know, one of those sort of things.
Very cool. I love that. You mentioned your mom never worried about getting hurt, never worried about, you know, her feelings being hurt. And it made me wonder, I mean, did you ever worry about getting hurt on horses? Because I know a lot of people that love to be around horses, but they get very nervous when they have to, you know, ride the horse or when they want to approach the horse because mm-hmm. They're such imposing animals. Did you ever worry about getting hurt on a horse?
No, but I grew up around horses. I shouldn't say no. Actually, I did go through a little period from age 10 to age 17 when I had a little bit of fear of horses, which was odd because I'd ridden horses my whole life, but it wasn't really that odd. I'd watched a horse run off with my brother down a paved road, and he was headed straight towards a busy highway that it was going to tee into that busy mm-hmm. highway, and the horse saw cars coming, I guess, and came to a sliding stop on the pavement, and they both had road rash on them. They were both okay, luckily. But I think after that, that was the first time I was 10. It was the first time I had any real awareness of that you could get hurt on a horse. And so from 10 to 17, I did go through a period when I was a little afraid of horses. But then I told you I graduated from high school early, and I went to the track to work because that's what I knew. And what I immediately noticed, that, you know, again, I was 98 pounds, 5'2". I thought watching people with the horses that it seemed a lot safer on top of them than underneath them. It seemed like if I was holding on to the horse, it would be really easy for them to, like, be on top of me next thing you knew, right? But if I was on top of them, it would be harder for them to do that. And
right.
So all of a sudden, I just got over it, and I just love to ride again. And so then throughout my career as a jockey, no, I never had that at all until the very end. And at the very end, it just became, you know, and you do have accidents when you're riding. I mean, sometimes you clip heels and go down. Somebody just jumps out in front of you, you know, makes a sharp left, which is why they review the films every day and riders are supposed to keep a straight course, but it doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes the horse just spooks. And so, yeah, towards the end, I started to envision that my horse was going to fall when my horse hadn't fallen. And so I thought, well, I guess it's time for me to move on. Like, it's always, I guess, in the back of your mind as a jockey, you have awareness that it's dangerous. But when that goes to the front of your mind, it's time to move on. And for me, it had started to drift to the front of my mind.
Wow. You know, I want to talk about the Derby and where you live, because you live in Louisville, and you are around this culture, the people of Louisville, the unique atmosphere that is down there, not just during the Derby and during that week leading up to the Derby, but all year round. Why is mm-hmm. this particular race so special to the people of Louisville?
Well, horse racing and horses in general are special to the people in the state of Kentucky. They are super important to the economy of Lexington, Kentucky, which is just 70, 80 miles away. And then Churchill Downs is an iconic venue that's been, I mean, it's, you know, like for famous baseball stadiums and football stadiums and people's cities. And so the Kentucky Derby itself, I would say, is arguably the most important race in the world, but definitely the most important race in America. And so for the people in Louisville to know that we have the most important race, horse race, in America for a long-honored tradition right here, I think it makes people pay more attention to, and they feel almost like obligated to, right? It's like mm-hmm. if you live at South Bend, you've got to pay attention a little bit to what Notre Dame's doing, right? Like you can't.
Right,
like,
exactly.
Oh, I didn't notice. Right? I didn't notice they were playing tomorrow. And so it's the same way if you're here in Kentucky. You can't be, you can't not pay attention because it feels a little bit like it would be sacrilege if you didn't. And then if you do pay attention to it, it's a sport that it is hard not to love. I mean, there's so much passion, so much enthusiasm. I mean, the thing that I love about thoroughbreds, Catherine, is that they are going to race, and they are going to race fast. I've seen them do it in fields, with or without a rider on their back. But what I admire and love so much about thoroughbreds is that they let us go for that ride with them. And that makes it so exciting because it's a partnership. And if they didn't want you on their back, you couldn't be there. And if they didn't want to race, you couldn't make them race. They're a little too big to impose a rule that they are against, right? And so the fact that they're like, okay, yeah, sure, we're going to race anyway. And if you want to come for the ride, that's awesome. And so once you're around horse racing a bit, it's hard not to fall in love with the thoroughbred and with the sport. And people here in Louisville have a lot of opportunities to be around it.
Yeah, they do. I mean, what I loved about what you just said, though, too, you let us go along on the ride with you as well. I mean, Donna, you have such a unique vantage point on top of a horse, just feet away from all the 20 Derby horses prior to those gates opening. You've done such a tremendous job through the years of really explaining the sport as well as anyone in the business. I mean, I remember when you stuck a pen in the track surface to illustrate just how wet it was, you know, the countless demonstrations or words that you have shared with us to understand the sport that you love so much. What are those moments like for you prior to those gates opening? What does it look like? What does it sound like, feel like to be in that moment where you are?
Well, first of all, Catherine, thank you for that. You've obviously done your homework. One of the things that I have said about, you know, as you well know, I mean, you've done so many shows for NBC and you know how much manpower they put into a show. And so we'll have 50 cameras and 75 microphones, and we'll have reporters set up all around Churchill Downs, and we're going to bring you exactly what it sounds like and exactly what it looks like. But what we can't bring into anybody's living room is what it feels like, and especially when they play My Old Kentucky Home. We've never been able to capture it on television for what it really is, because what it is you have a moment when they play My Old Kentucky Home where 150,000 people suddenly start feeling the same thing. They start singing the same song. They start feeling that same reverence for the sport, for the state of Kentucky, for the horse. And then the jockeys are out there on the racetrack by that point, and they're on their horses, and they also feel it. And then as soon as the song is over and the crowd erupts, the horses usually erupt a little bit too because of the crowd noise. And then the horses gallop off to go do their warm-up prior to the start. And it's during that time that I feel so grateful to be able to be a part of it, to be able to be there, to be out on the track on a horse. And so I have such a great view of the crowd, and I have a great view of the horses. And so for me, I just feel tremendous gratitude. But then after that happens and the horses all gallop off, then I have to get back into work mode of, let's see how this horse is doing. Let's see how that horse is doing. Make sure that none of the horses are losing their composure out on the racetrack. And so then you just go back into the journalism mode of making sure that you are seeing everything that's possible for you to see. And then if there's anything important, get that information back to the viewers.
Well, the most important interview you do is right at the end. I mean, you are the very first one to interview the winning jockey right after that race. Again, a unique perspective. You're riding horseback right alongside the winning jockey. Do you have a favorite moment from any of the interviews you've done, or maybe a funny story? I'm sure it's really hard to pick one, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I'll give you a funny story once, but it's like not on my highlight reel, I assure you.
Even better.
I want to say one of my first, it was Breeders' Cup, not Derby, one of my first Breeders' Cup shows, and the producer was David Michaels. I'm sure you've done some work with David. And the rider that won the race was a French jockey who I could barely understand. His accent was very thick. But even before I finished the question to him, David had said, you only have time for one question. And I'm thinking, great, because I can't understand what this guy is saying. And so I didn't really listen that hard. I'm sure if I would have listened harder, I probably could have picked up what he was saying. But then right as I'm supposed to like throw it back to Tom Hammond, David said, you have time for one more question. And I went, let's go back to Tom Hammond. Because, I mean, how do you ask a question of somebody who just gave you a long answer you didn't understand anything of?
I don't know. I have no idea. I've never had that happen.
And I wasn't prepared. I wasn't supposed to ask him another question. So anyway, I hate it when that happens. But Anyway, yeah, I would say my favorite two interviews are usually Calvin Burrell and Mike Smith, because they're both jockeys who, I mean, as you well know, really the challenge and the goal that we have as sideline reporters is to try to get there right after that big moment when the athlete is still feeling what they feel instead of thinking what they think. Like, we don't want them to have moved from their head to their, I mean, from their heart to their head yet. And so that's why I jump in there on my horse and try to catch them in that moment. But Calvin Burrell and Mike Smith really do know how to keep that emotion and that moment alive in their heart, and they don't get too fast to move into their head. And so it's really nice to catch that. And when Calvin Burrell won his first Derby, anybody who ever watched that won't forget it, because he was crying, and it was in 2007 on Horse Named Street Sense. Yeah, and he was crying, and I think all of America fell in love with him, anybody who saw it that day anyway. So, yeah, those are my favorites, is when they are still feeling what they feel.
Well, I've got two $1 million questions for you. For the first one, I know people that have worked on our Derby show for years and never really get a good answer, so maybe you can give us one. What does a trainer actually do?
Well, a trainer for a horse is very much like a personal fitness trainer or a coach for a human athlete. But the big challenge that a horse trainer has as opposed to the personal fitness trainer or the coach is that they're not getting any verbal feedback. So it's right. Not like the athlete comes in the next day and says, "Hey, my glutes are burnt. They're toast. We can't do glutes today," right? So the trainer has to be much more intuitive and has to be a bit of a horse whisperer. And they have to pick up on the horse's behavior, whether or not that was too much or not enough. And so the way that they do that is a lot of trainers like to go to the barn in the afternoon just to see the horses and where they're standing in the stall and how fast they run to their feed tub, or if they eat all their feed in the afternoon, because that tells them a lot about their energy level, about their level of happiness. But, you know, again, we go back to, you can't make horses run. If they didn't want to run, you just can't make them run. But what you can try to do is keep them happy. And if you see a horse that's suddenly not being happy or seems to be fatigued, then as a trainer, now that's your cue that you've got to back off a little bit. And if they are, like, tearing the stall down and trying to, you know, run through the webbing, you need to do a little bit more with them. So that's what they do, I guess.
Wow. Is there a secret to communicating with the thoroughbreds? I mean, I know, you know, there's got to be a trick, a way that you can really understand the horses. Obviously, they don't talk. We're aware of that. But,
yeah,
I mean, there's mannerisms that you're paying attention to.
Yeah, the biggest secret is just listening. And so the mannerisms that the trainer looks for are all those things I talked about. When you're a jockey, the ears are really important. So what the horse is doing with their ears tells you a lot. For instance, if you're in front and you're just sitting there easy in a race and you know, there's nobody around you yet, and all of a sudden your horse's right ear goes back, both ears are forward, and now all of a sudden the right ear goes back, you know somebody's making a move on the right side of you, like, because your horse just told you that. I remember another time I rode a horse who I turned for home, and I was in front, and I went to turn over my riding crop because there were horses coming, and as soon as I turned over my riding crop, she pinned her ears back. And so I just put it away immediately because I could tell that she wasn't going to want any sort of encouragement from the crop. And so I just hand rode her all the way to the wire, and she won. And when I came back, the trainer said, "Oh, my God, I meant to tell you to try not hitting her because I'm not sure that she appreciates that or moves up from it. How did you know?" And I said, "Well, she told me." Like, when I turned for home and I went to go use it, she said, "Please don't do that." And so I didn't. And so, yeah, they tell you, if you're paying attention, through lots of subtle signs. And the more you're around the horses, the more you learn to look for those signs. I mean, it's a lot like dogs. Yeah. Horses and dogs are so much alike. You know, they're all herd animals. They all like to have an alpha, a leader. If you're not going to be the alpha, they'll be the alpha. But it's better if they're not. So they're not a whole lot different than dogs in the way that you just have to pay attention to their subtle communications.
Well, it's interesting when you were talking about that. The first thing I thought of, I mean, I grew up with animals, cats and dogs, and the ears, it's so apparent when an animal is not not very happy at that moment because the ears are pinned back or one goes back or they're paying attention to something and you can tell right away. So that really resonated with me, yeah, with the horses. But how interesting that you knew somebody was coming up on the right in that situation. I love that. Those stories are awesome.
And Donna, that's a really good analogy on your point. I hadn't thought about the ears with the dogs. And yeah, same thing.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. My nickname in my house growing up, I don't know if you remember the show Alf, the show that was on for years, a sitcom. Yeah, and he's always going after the cat because he, like, wants to eat the cat. Well, I am obsessed with animals, and I love to snuggle with them. And the cats growing up, like, just would walk the other way when I would come in the room. My dad nicknamed me Alf because he's like, they know you're coming. And the sure sign was the ears pinned back. I'm like, the cat doesn't like me because his ears are pinned back. But, no, they were just trying to get away from me because I grabbed them and pet them too much. But anyway,
yeah,
I do love my animals.
You're holding me from my belly. I don't like that.
Exactly. Of course, everybody wants to know your pick for this year's Derby. But before we get the pick, I do want to know kind of what the factors are that you consider when you're deciding to pick for the race.
Yeah, that's a good question because, again, you know, we've got horses that converge from all over the United States. And so when it comes down to it on Derby Day, in some respects, you're comparing apples to oranges because you've got horses who've never faced each other, and now suddenly they're facing each other. And so you have to look at, you know, the quality of their race. We have speed numbers that we use. In the daily racing form, one of those numbers is called the buyer figure. And so the buyer figure itself tries to sort of equalize all those things, like how fast was the track, meaning was it a track that was heavy or fast, where horses were racing fast times over it. How deep was the competition? That, you know, how tough was the race that horse was in? And so it compares a lot of different equations to come up with, influences to come up with this equation. And so the buyer number is important, but really what it comes down to is just believing not just who you think is going to be the fastest, but who you think is going to get the trip. So there are some horses that you think, well, I think this horse is the best horse in the race. However, this horse needs for a really fast pace up front, and I don't see that happening. Because if that fast pace happens, the horse will just lay back, wait for the pace to collapse and come running. But if the fast pace doesn't happen, then they can't do that. And so you look for a horse that can sort of make its own way, a horse that doesn't have to rely on the pace up front being super fast, or the pace up front being super slow, a horse who's tactical, who can lay close or lay just 2, 3, 4 lengths off. So that's what, yeah, you have to find a horse who you think will be suitable for the Kentucky Derby and getting a good run into that first turn and being able to sort of cut out his own sort of a trip.
So do you have a pick for this year's Derby?
I do, yes. For me, it came down to Omaha Beach. He's the horse that Richard Mandela has. And Mike Smith, who won last year's Triple Crown on Justify, rides Omaha Beach. And it's worth noting that even though he won last year's Triple Crown on Justify for Bob Baffert, he had to choose between a different Bob Baffert horse, Roadster, and Richard Mandela's horse. And he rides a lot more for Bob Baffert. And so the fact that he thought that much of Omaha Beach to choose him over Roadster, I felt like said a lot about Mikey's confidence in Omaha Beach. And then I was out at the track this morning, actually, and I watched Omaha Beach train, and he's an imposing individual. He's really beautiful. He's got the size. He's got, we call it the scope, meaning he looks like a horse who has this sort of a body type, the long length to be able to get the distance. This is the furthest any of these horses has ever run, right? And so that's the other thing you're trying to figure out is who's going to be able to get the mile and a quarter distance. And so he looked to me like he had all of the right tools to, yeah, I mean, he's going to be my favorite. That doesn't make him a winner, though, Catherine. I mean, look at Mind That Bird at 50-1 in 2009.
That's true. Yes, I do remember. I know. Well, I mean, hey, we want to know your pick. Of course, we're never going to hold it against you if it's not the pick. I mean, everybody's got to pick their horse. But yes, of course, we value your opinion, and that's cool. So, all right, one question before you go. I know we like to have some fun, too, with some fun off-the-cuff questions. And I have to say, you know, you have some of the most beautiful skin I've ever seen in my life. I mean, you are always radiating. You're always glowing in all the pictures of you and on television. So we have a very large female audience on this podcast. And I'd love to know if you have any skincare secrets.
Wow. Well, thank you. That's a huge compliment, especially coming from you, because you have beautiful skin. People ask me that, and honestly, my answer is almost always water. I've drank a minimum of 2 quarts of water, usually 3 to 4 quarts of water a day since I was 22 years old, because I just started it when I became a professional athlete. And so it's something that I've done that I think hydration is absolutely the most important thing you can do for your skin. And, you know, it's just like the spring, when the spring is so beautiful because we've had a lot of rain, and it's not that people went out there and threw Miracle Grow on the plants, right?
Right, exactly.
Spring.
All right. So there we go.
I do take good care of my skin, but I think what I put on it is less important than what I put into my body.
Hydrating, right. That's wonderful advice. Yeah. Well, we're so happy to have you, Donna. We look forward to seeing your beautiful smiley face in the next couple weeks and in the months ahead in our Triple Crown coverage. And have fun. Best of luck with the upcoming races. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, Catherine, thanks for having me on. I'm a huge fan of your work here. You've worked with a bunch of my colleagues, and I love what you do. Keep up the great work, and it's been a pleasure to be on with you.
Such a great conversation with Donna. I hope you guys all enjoyed that one as much as I did. So fun to talk to her and get her thoughts on horse racing and everything else. So next up, Brittany Erton, who we caught up with while she was riding to her job in L.A. Brittany, thanks so much for taking the time to join us. It's the most exciting time of the year, I would bet, for you. The first race of the Triple Crown coming up with the Kentucky Derby. So just tell me what this time of year means to you.
Well, first and foremost, Catherine, thank you for having me on. I mean, it truly is the two most exciting minutes in sports is the Kentucky Derby. So we race year-round, but when you get into the spring, you know that the first Saturday in May is coming, and it's really exciting to see the horses that have not only debuted when they were two and did well and see how they transition to 3 years old, but perhaps even the horses that we didn't see debut last year, hence like a Justify, who probably was a complete anomaly and once-in-a-lifetime type of horse. But you can feel the energy. You can feel the crowd and the fans getting excited to see a peak performance by one of these incredible athletes on the first Saturday in May. It's great.
It's great for you as well, because, I mean, this is, you grew up around the sport, you've been around it your whole life, and now you've had the opportunity the last couple of seasons to be a part of our broadcast with the NBC Sports team. So what was the most unique experience you had when you first got started with the television side of covering the Kentucky Derby?
Well, it's completely different, and I have to say, covering the Triple Crown last year and witnessing a Triple Crown for the first time on NBC was an extremely surreal experience. It's something that I watched growing up. My father's a trainer, and I never had the opportunity to go to the Kentucky Derby because I said, I'm not going to go even as a fan until my dad has a horse running. But he had a horse running the same year that California Chrome ran. And to experience that and have a horse that I was associated with and do the walkover and then getting to cover it last year, completely different experiences, but nonetheless, absolutely unforgettable. I love sharing the stories of each of these people that have taken the, you know, obviously the road to the Kentucky Derby is a long one, and it's a difficult one. So out of the thousands of horses that are born each year, only 20 make it into the starting gate. And so that's a special moment for each of these connections.
Well, I love just last year watching you in those three races. And, you know, there's certain people that broadcast certain sports that you can just tell love it. I mean, it's one thing to be a broadcaster, but to really just own the space and the enthusiasm and the excitement and the smiling and the genuine care that you have for this sport is just so refreshing to see. And it really captivates the viewer. I found that every time you were on camera, I mean, I was really so interested in what you were saying and so interested in everything you had to share with us. Such a unique perspective. And you mentioned your dad, and I know that is a huge part of who you are in this sport and how you got to learn this sport. Your dad, obviously, trainer Peter Erton. And I wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on his advice to you growing up, getting involved in this sport, and some of the valuable lessons that he taught you along the way.
Well, you know, it's too funny. I'll be honest. I never expected to be involved in horse racing from a career standpoint. I always loved being a part of it as a fan, as my dad's biggest fan, no doubt, but I never expected to cover it. So for him, he just, and my mom as well, were always so supportive of me following my dreams, whatever they might be. And no dream was too big. And I think that my trajectory in this industry is a true testament to how they raised me, that I can achieve anything that I put my mind to. And at first it was wanting to be in films and acting, and that was my absolute passion since I was three. And then I just fell in love with the sport again. And I'm sure you feel the same way when you're covering hockey, that you just love what you do. And I think that I hope comes across to the viewer. I hope that they're enjoying it by watching it as much as I'm enjoying being a part of it. So for him, for my parents, my mom, my dad, my entire family, they've been nothing but supportive. And they just keep telling me, keep going, keep striving to achieve wherever you want to get in this world. And I think that's helped me get to where I am today. So I'm very grateful.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the acting thing. I do want to touch on that for a minute, because after attending Cal Poly and USC, you graduated with a business degree, and you really wanted to follow that passion that you had of being an actress. You went to an acting conservatory in Santa Monica, did some commercials, theatrical roles. I mean, you've got the IMDb account. I mean, your profile's there. So what was it about acting, you know, aside from the passion that you were feeling that was kind of drawing you back to horse racing, what was it about acting that really just did not resonate with you?
I think it was a matter of the struggle of never knowing when you're going to get that next job. The auditioning process really wore on me, if I'm being completely honest. It was difficult to constantly go through the audition process, get a call back, be on a veil, and then not know whether or not you're going to get the job. And so it's almost you're putting all of this work into it to potentially get the job. And then the letdown was difficult for me. It was hard for me to bounce back from. And I also found that as much as I loved acting, I perhaps enjoyed just being myself a little bit more. And I really, since a child, I am very inquisitive. I think I like to ask questions. So it was a natural progression for me to use what I've learned in front of the camera to be able to be comfortable, but also to make whoever I'm speaking with feel comfortable, but also just using the, you know, curiosity that I innately have. It all kind of gelled together. And don't get me wrong, I miss being a part of my acting classes, and I love going to movies and think, wow, maybe I want to delve back into that. But I think I found something I love more.
Yeah, don't go anywhere, because we will miss you too much if you go anywhere. So, you know,
not planning on it.
Yeah, good. So one of the things that is also interesting about you is that you never actually rode horses. Is that correct? I mean, you were around the sport, but you never really did that. You liked soccer. You liked dancing. Was it just something that never really, you know, transpired for you?
It's probably one of the most surprising things that I tell people, because my father was a jockey and he claims that he was a terrible jockey, but won about 100 races, then got too big and transitioned to training. My mother's petite as well. They just never pushed it on me. They always let me do what I was interested in. And so from a young age, that was first gymnastics, then soccer. And then I spent pretty much most of my middle school and high school years dancing. It was 15 hours a week for me. I absolutely loved it. So within that time, I never had the desire to ride horses. I love being around them, albeit a little bit terrified of them at the same time. And now I wish I learned, because I think I'm too far gone. I don't think I could get aboard a horse right now and actually learn how to ride properly.
Well, you mentioned your dad about, you know, he transitioned from being a jockey to a trainer, and how he's been such a big influence in you covering the sport. You also, I mean, you recently had to interview your dad when he won a race. Can you share that story? Because, I mean, it's way better hearing it from you than reading about it, and I just need to hear it from your lips.
Okay, so I work for TVG full-time, and that's really who brought me into this sport, and they sent us to Louisiana, where I'd never been to before, to the fairgrounds to cover the Louisiana Derby. So you'll see, by my standards, in the Kentucky Derby, he won that race. But my father had three horses running on the day, and one of them was named Core Belief in the New Orleans Handicap. He hadn't raced in quite some time, but he always shown my dad a lot of talent. So for me, I'm supposed to be completely unbiased. Before the race, I think I'm great at that. After the race, not so much. So they're coming around the turn, and Core Belief is in the lead, and I just lose it. I am jumping up and down, screaming at the top of my lungs. I'll admit it's a complete out-of-body experience where I have no idea that anybody's even around me. Little do I know that my cameraman, Miles, is filming me as I'm jumping up and down looking like a lunatic. But for me, just a really special moment, finding my dad in the crowd, giving him a hug. Like I said, his biggest fan. I think he's a sensational trainer, an incredible human being. So for him to get, those type of victories is really special to be there.
Yeah, but you kind of, what I was told was that you flipped a switch kind of, right? You had to kind of put that excitement aside and flip a switch and become journalist Brittany, who had to interview her dad.
I did, and you could probably see the excitement just kind of spewing out of me. But yeah, I've had to do that before, and it's a true joy of mine to be able to interview him after a race. But I think I'm able to separate the two. There's no doubt about it. When watching the interview, you can tell I'm excited for him. But for the viewers, I want to ask the right questions and to hear what he has to say in response to the performance and not let my emotions get in the middle of it, although it's hard.
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. I had a similar experience in South Korea last year when Team USA, the women's team, won the gold medal in a very dramatic finish. Cameras caught Jeremy Roenick, and Jeremy Roenick kind of jumped up and celebrated and grabbed me in the mix of it. But I was so excited. And I remember yours and my colleague, Mike Tirico, saying to me, you got to be careful. We can't be all pro USA. I'm like, what? How come? I'm so passionate about our country and celebrating it. But yes, you are right. There is a journalistic integrity that comes in that. And I can't imagine interviewing dad. That must be so exciting. I want to talk about something.
It's tough, but it's great. It's a fun place to be in, right?
It is 100%. We're caught up in wonderful moments, and you can't help but get excited about it. There's something you're really passionate about, and I think it's so interesting because many of us watch horse racing, and I consider myself a very novice viewer in the sense that I don't understand all of the betting that comes involved and all of the terminology, but I enjoy it so much, and I try to read and really educate myself. And you were one of six people who got together around a dining room table. You decided to create something for those in the industry and also outside of it as a form of education to have. It's a voice called I Am Horse Racing. And that is the campaign as a result of this conversation that you had with these people. So I want you to share why you decided to do that and educate not only people like me on the outside of the industry, but also people within the horse racing industry to learn more about those who love this sport.
It is such a niche sport, and we're in a time right now that obviously is quite difficult, and we wanted to do our part as people in this industry who have gained so much from it. It's given me a purpose. These horses, this industry, these people, it's really a family. But I think from an outsider's perspective, the trainer, the jockey, and the owner, but there's so many more people that are involved that truly dedicate their lives to this sport, but more importantly to the horses. You have one horse, and there are probably 10, 12, 15 people connected to that one individual horse. And they all have a story. They all have a reason as to why they fell in love with these animals and the sport and why they've stayed in it. And I think for us, that's something we really wanted to share, because I'm lucky enough to be at the track 4 of the 7 days of the week, and I get to speak to many of these people and hear their story. So we wanted an outlet to be able to share those. But not only that, there are plenty of aspects of the industry that not many people know about. And so we also wanted to use it, as you said, as a tool of education. As simple as something like the Triple Crown, I don't think many people know that out of all the horses that are born in 1 year, only 20 get into the starting gate, and that's their one shot. I don't think many people really understand how difficult it is to get there, and it's something to be celebrated. Also, the care that these horses are given, that's of the utmost importance for the I Am Horse Racing campaign, to highlight the veterinary care. These horses get acupuncture, dental work, brand new shoes on, therapeutic treatment. It's a lot goes into these athletes, much like a human athlete would, in taking care of their body. And all of these things we really wanted to highlight. And lead up to the Kentucky Derby, with all eyes on us, there's no better time to do so than now. So it's been incredibly received by the industry, and I hope it does get out to the general public, because there's lots of incredible information, stories, people that love this sport and have a lot to say about it.
Yeah, and anyone listening that's interested in it, it's called I Am Horse Racing. You guys have a website, an Instagram account with wonderful quotes and beautiful pictures and testimonials from people involved in the sport. I mean, the sport, these are the backstories, a lot of the behind-the-scenes folks who people never see on Derby Day. We never see them at the Belmont. We never see them at the Preakness. But they are working pre-dawn and after sunset to make sure that these horses are working, that the race is going to work for the horse. I mean, I think it's so interesting, and I guess it happens in any sport, but more so when you're looking at this beautiful creature that is about to do, like you said, the most exciting 2 minutes in all of sports, about to race in this wonderful race with millions of eyeballs, and there's a team behind that horse. I mean, it's just like any other team that's trying to accomplish a championship, right?
And going into that starting gate, you truly see the hard work that's been put into this single horse. I don't know many other industries where you have people that wake up at 3 in the morning and don't leave until 8 p.m. at night, and they're literally there for the horse. We wouldn't be anywhere without the horse. And just speaking from my own personal standpoint and witnessing my dad and how he trains, we'll go on vacation, the first thing he wants to do is come back and see his horses. So there are so many people that are connected. We truly are a big family, and the horse is the integral part of it.
Well, you talked about traveling, and I'd love to talk more about you here because, you know, your Instagram account is so fun to follow, the traveling that you love to do and post pictures from. What are some of the greatest places that you've had the opportunity to travel to, and why is it important for you to see so many other places around the world?
I've always loved traveling because every state, every country, every culture is so different. And that's very interesting to me and how people live their lives differently in other countries. So traveling for me has always been very important as well, because I think there's a lot for me to personally learn from other countries and grow. So I, from a young age, have always had a desire to see the world, and I've been lucky enough to travel to many places with horse racing. I just got back from Dubai. That was my second trip there. I'm going to be going to England with NBC covering Royal Ascot, so I cannot wait for that. But outside of it, Italy, Europe, there's just so much that we could learn and really take away from other cultures, not just how they do things from a racing standpoint, but just in general. There's something I very much so admire about the European culture and how relaxed they are. I find myself getting all too stressed out sometimes. And on top of it, I'm a huge foodie. I love good food. So trying different food from other cultures is a big highlight of mine.
Yes, you love good wine too. We see that on there. A girl after my own heart. Good food and wine. I mean, what can't go wrong, right? It's so neat though, because you mentioned the different perspectives that you get from around the country, and I agree with you with the European culture of, you know, relaxing a little bit more. And I mean, we do not. And I live on the East Coast. You're fortunate enough to live on the West Coast. You have a little bit more of that than we do out in California. But certainly,
I love the energy of New York though. I'd move there in a heartbeat. There's something about New York that even now they're going a mile in a minute.
Yes.
I still feel a calmness.
I know. Everybody always asks me, I don't know how you live there. I said, well, there is no other energy in the world like New York City. I mean, you can't not appreciate it. It's so vibrant. But listen, I do love to visit California too. You guys have it pretty nice out there. When you think back to the role models that you had, Brittany, and the people that you really looked up to, and I know originally you thought you might be an actress, so maybe it's different than what it is now, but who are some of the women that you really admired that you were interested in learning from and gaining more insight and education from?
I think first it starts with my mom. She is incredibly hardworking and so kind, and I really admire her work ethic. She owns her own jewelry store. It's something that's been around for 30 years within the family, but she somehow still finds the time to spend time with my father and go on trips, and she knows how to have this work-life balance, which I think can be really difficult, especially in this day and age where work is really at the forefront. So she will always be first to me. I truly admire her and what she, how she handles life, and how she, I appreciate how she's raised me. I've learned a lot from her. From a career standpoint, when I was acting, I always admired Julia Roberts' career. I think that she has made her way throughout this industry, which can be very difficult in such a classy way. So she's always somebody that I very much so have looked up to in the acting standpoint. And now moving forward, I'm really inspired by my colleagues. There's a woman I work with at TVG named Christina Blacker, and she has three children and works her butt off, still finds time for her friends, and she's extremely talented. And so for me, a personal standpoint, I get to work with her all the time. I think she's been a role model of mine since I started at TVG, and I don't know how she does it. I constantly say that. I believe there was a movie called I Don't Know How She Does It, and she's the epitome of that. A superwoman, super mom, super friend. And so for me, I really gained a lot by working with her and being her friend. She's actually whose table we were around for I Am Horse Racing.
Oh, that's great. Oh, I love it. We've come full circle. You know, you talk about that balance, and we discuss that a lot here on the podcast with so many different women that come on. For you personally, what brings you back to center? You know, when you're working a lot, you're covering tremendous races, you're traveling a lot. What is it that really brings you and centers you back to your roots?
It's definitely a challenge for me, and it's something I'm still trying to figure out and manage. I find that especially leaving on Monday night for the Derby, I know I'm going to be 1,000% focused on that week at hand. But for me, yoga has been a massive help mentally, physically. I try and get into class as much as I can because I do feel like it centers me. At the same time, spending time with friends over a good glass of wine or wonderful dinner really helps me out and kind of takes me away from focusing truly only on work, because this industry is more of a lifestyle than it is a job, and that's what I love about it. But at the same time, you have to find a balance. So all of those things, I'm still figuring it out, but hopefully we'll find that equal balance soon.
Yeah, if you find it, let me know how that works out. No, you're so right, though. I mean, you have to find time to yourself. You have to find time. You do go through chunks of very intense work time where you have to focus and block everybody else out. And that's just the way it is. But I loved what you said about, you know, yoga and the things that you know make you happy and are going to bring you back to where you need to be. So that's awesome.
And it is a television show. I mean, I'm a big Game of Thrones fan, so that's all.
There you go.
Check out for a good hour and a half.
Perfect. Perfect. And we love what we do. It is a lifestyle. But you know what? You can only do it if you really have passion for it. Otherwise, it is
absolutely
too arduous of a task. Okay, a couple quick questions. I know we've kept you long, and I want to make sure I'm respectful of your time, but a couple questions for you leading up to the Derby. It'd be fun to kind of ask your perspective on betting 101 or tips around the Derby. Mm-hmm. I mean, someone like me who's coming in who wants to place a bet, what would you recommend to me?
Well, I think because this year is wide open, you're going to get a good price even on the favorite. So I think that leaning on people that you know, say a Bob Baffert or a Mike Smith, you can't really go wrong there. It's honestly, for those going to the Derby, I think it's all about having a great time. Pick a horse's name that you enjoy. Pick the silks that you like. For the completely novice fan, go that direction. Have fun with it because you're probably going to get a great price. For me, I'll give you three names of horses that I think have a massive shot, and you'll likely get a decent to average price on it. Omaha Beach is likely to be the favorite. He's running for a Hall of Fame trainer that has never won the Kentucky Derby. He has not been back in 15 years. It's just a wonderful story. Mike Smith is on that horse, who won the Triple Crown last year. Roadster and Game Winner for the Hall of Famer Bob Baffert. Those two horses also key. And last but surely not least, Tacitus. It's a hard name to remember, but the horse is for Hall of Famer Bill Mott, who has also never won the Kentucky Derby. We've got like a lot of great storylines here, so I would hope that people can tune into the broadcast and we can share those stories with them. But if all else fails, go with your favorite name.
Okay, that's usually the one I go for, so I should be in good shape with that. Yeah, it's usually a name or a color that I like. But and finally, Brittany, I mean, part of the excitement and the lure of the Derby, outside of the mint juleps, are the outfits, mm-hmm. the hats. The dresses, the shoes. Your wardrobe for the Derby. Tell us about how you planned it. I know maybe you can't reveal anything, but are you excited for what you get to wear next weekend?
I can't wait. I actually tried on my dress yesterday, getting it altered, and bought a pair of shoes yesterday as well. And I have a milliner that's based locally named Karen Morris, who is designing a hat for me. So that will all be Derby Day, and it will be very Derby-centric. So it's a run for the roses, if that gives you any hints. And I love Kentucky Oaks Day because everybody wears pink, and we're obviously putting a highlight on research for breast cancer, and it's a wonderful day. They do the breast cancer walk at the beginning of the day. And for me, I'm going a little bit edgy and wearing a pink suit, which I'm quite excited about.
I can't wait. I can't wait. You always look wonderful. So we're so excited. Brittany, enjoy your final weekend of serenity before this craziness starts and before you get to go to Louisville and enjoy the Derby. We look so forward to seeing you on the broadcast in the next couple weeks with all the events you're going to cover for NBC Sports. And thank you so much for taking the time for joining us on the On Her Turf podcast.
Kevin, I can't thank you enough for having me. I think this is an incredible podcast, so I really am honored to be a part of it. Thank you.
Yay. A special thank you to Donna and Brittany for joining us today. You can catch them on NBC's Kentucky Derby coverage Saturday, May 4th. And you can download the On Her Turf podcast wherever you download your podcasts. Let us know what you think. We want to hear from you. Be sure to chime in and follow us on Instagram at On Her Turf. Have a great rest of your day, everyone. And be sure to check us out the next time for the On Her Turf podcast.